From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. New data from the annual UCLA survey of college freshmen reveals that first-year students feel more stressed, think they may well need more than 4 years to complete a college degree, and could well transfer to another college to complete their undergraduate education. And the harsh sentence, including 1,000 lashes, imposed on a Saudi blogger for crimes against Islam, has been a catalyst for discussion about a clash between Western academic values and the cultures and laws of Middle Eastern nations. Hi. This is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation today, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comment section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we will talk about stressed out college freshmen. For almost five decades, the new year has always brought new data about the aspiration and experiences of the nation's college freshmen, courtesy of the Cooperative Institutional Research Program, or CIRP. Based at UCLA's Higher Education Research Institute, CIRP is the nation's largest continuing study of American higher education. This year, some 153,000 college freshmen at 2,227 four-year colleges and universities participated in the fall 2014 survey. The new survey provides a rich array of data about student aspirations and expectations, their self-assessments, the college application process, and factors affecting students' choice of college, and more. The new data tell us, for example, that smoking is down this year, expectations for transferring to another college are up, and a growing number of students are stressed out and feeling depressed. Significant numbers of students, especially those at less selective institutions, expect they will need more than 4 years to complete a college degree. And the aspirations and expectations for advanced degrees continue to rise. Fully three-fourths of the 2014 freshmen hope to complete a graduate degree compared to just half in 1974. Perhaps not surprisingly to many, women as a group now have higher degree aspirations than men, a significant reversal from 40 years ago when just 15% of women and 26% of men expressed hopes to pursue doctoral or professional degrees. Joining us for the conversation are Kevin Egan, who is the Interim Director of the Higher Education Research Institute and the Interim Director of the CIRP, and also an Assistant Professor in Residence at UCLA. Kevin Kruger is the President of NASPA, the Student Affairs Administrators in Higher Education, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Kevin Egan, I need to begin with a quick methodological question. Because the CIRP data, the freshman survey data, are so widely known, and this project has been going on for so long, launched in 1966, I want to be clear that the trend data currently reported are, in fact, apples and apples. Many know that, for example, in the early years of the CIRP, the project included first-time, full-time freshmen in community colleges. That's not the case currently. So as we begin our conversation about the 2014 data and the trends, are, in fact, the trends been renormed in terms of just full-time, first-time students at four-year institutions?
Yes, I think that that's an important point to keep in mind. Community colleges are not participating at the same rates that they did 10 or 15 years ago. And so whenever we highlight the norms and the trends in the monograph, we have adjusted the trends by removing the community colleges from 20 and 30 years ago from those numbers. And so when we look at the trends, we're only looking at students who are first-time, full-time freshmen at four-year institutions across the last 49 years.
And as an extension of that, you know, during economic downturns, we see shifts in student populations. Students that might have gone to four-year institutions buy down in community colleges. What's your sense in terms of what that does in terms of the student population participating in the survey and the national norms?
So I think that by focusing on students at four-year institutions, the sample may be less economically and racially, ethnically diverse. And I think that that's important to keep in mind as we talk about some of these trends.
Great, thank you. So let's actually go into the data. A big lead in the national press at Inside Higher Education, the New York Times and elsewhere, was about mental health issues. Several indicators from the 2014 data suggest that freshmen are more stressed than their peers in previous years and may have a lower self-assessment of their overall mental health, as reflected by the fact that 10% report themselves as being frequently feeling depressed and only half see themselves as being above average or better compared to their peers on a self-assessment of emotional health. Let me start with you again, Kevin Egan. At CIRP, What contributes to these issues about mental health and today's college freshmen seeming to be more stressed than their peers in prior years?
So I think looking at these two trends in context with a couple of other points that we highlighted in the report are important. We highlighted in the report that students were leaving high school having partied less, drinking less, and socializing less with their friends, while also studying more. And so we think that it may be the case that students are so focused on their academics in that final year of high school and not providing themselves with a social outlet that those two factors combined are contributing to greater levels of stress, greater levels of feeling depressed, and lower self-rated emotional health as they begin college.
You know, the emphasis on more academics that you cite, is that across all sectors or just among students at elite institutions or selective institutions, Kevin Egan?
Across all sectors, we're seeing that students are reporting that they're spending more time studying. And so it really is a collective, comprehensive assessment where students across all types of institutions, both broad access and selective, are studying more.
And Kevin Krueger, in terms of the stress issues, as you think about your peers in the student affairs world at colleges and universities across the country, is the stress reflected in the freshman survey data reflected in traffic at counseling centers and in terms of the other work that student affairs professionals are doing these days?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an ongoing trend we've seen over the last decade or so, an increase in the number of students who express issues of stress, feeling overwhelmed, anxiety. All counseling centers have seen, you know, rising cases over the last decades related to that. And I think, you know, Kevin mentioned a couple of things. I think the academic pressure clearly is an issue. I think the cost of college has also created a factor here, that the rising cost, the pressure to be employed, the competition, all that I think increases the stress level for students coming in. But of course that stress level continues through college. You know, that we have, you know, solid data over the years about the extent to which students are feeling overwhelmed and overwhelming anxiety throughout their entire 4 years. And so we see this not just as a freshman experience, but really something that continues through the entire academic experience.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, let me ask you to comment on two issues that have been part of the conversation thus far. First, Kevin Egan mentioned the fact that students seem to be more engaged in academics. That would seem counter to some other national data we've seen from other sources, at least in terms of the college side. And second, in terms of what you're seeing and what you and your colleagues who cover higher education at large are seeing about the stress issues.
I would agree with you that some of the data we look at in NESI would run perhaps against this trend of more academics, although, of course, the freshman survey is really a high school senior survey, so we may be looking at different populations. On the stress issue, it's really worrying to a lot of senior college administrators. One, you see the issue that Kevin mentioned of counseling centers getting increases in the number of students, but you also have increasingly a large population of students who have been treated for mental health issues, likely with medication, before they arrive at college, likely in many cases continuing the medication, but without seeking counseling, which is usually frowned upon. And we see reports about suicides. We had two murder-suicides on campuses this week. These represent college leaders' worst fears and any parents' worst fears. And even if they are obviously not the norm, mental health issues, broadly defined, are a huge issue today for campus administrators.
Kevin Krueger, are mental health issues more of an issue today than they were 5, 10, or 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Scott's raised that. I think, you know, you can kind of separate, there's two areas here. The normal kind of developmental issues of you know, stress, anxiety, you know, feeling homesick, those kinds of things, which is one case. But we really, as Scott indicated, are very concerned about the more severe, significant psychological issues that are coming to campus. And again, if you look at the counseling center directors and their issues, they would say that they've seen a significant increase in serious psychological issues. You look at the American College Health Association assessment, you know, 46% of students saying they feel things are hopeless. 32%, a third, saying they're so depressed it's difficult to function. We know that college student suicide is still the second leading cause of death. So this is a major issue for us. And Getting students to identify themselves and to seek help is critical, as Scott mentioned. You know, unfortunately, what we know is that many of the students who do commit suicide on campus never saw a counselor or never sought help. And that's a real gap in terms of our ability to reach out and provide some therapeutic assistance for those students.
Kevin Egan, I want to turn to another part of the survey data this year that was highlighted in the materials from the Institute, not picked up, however, in terms of a lot of the media coverage, and that is student self-assessment of whether or not they're going to need extra time to complete a degree, more than 4 years, and the likelihood of transferring. This plays out in terms of their own expectations of the college experience, but potentially has public policy consequences, given what we've seen from the Obama administration and from the states about rating campuses, persistence of the freshman cohort, time to degree, et cetera. Those numbers are striking in terms of what emerges, you know, across all sectors from the most selective and rising as you go to the least selective. Talk a bit about both the student data there and how that plays into some of the public policy issues, if you would, please.
Sure. So what we were seeing is that students who are starting college and taking, keep in mind that they take the freshman survey either during summer orientation or in the first couple of weeks of their freshman year. And at the least selective institutions in our sample, those with average SAT or SAT equivalent scores of 1,030 or below, those students, 30% of those students were coming to college saying during orientation or in the first 2 weeks of their freshman year that they intended to transfer. That's compared to 12 to 15% of students saying the same at the most selective institutions in the sample. And so in the context of what's coming forth from or what's been put out so far by the U.S. Department of Education with respect to college ratings is that if these students end up following through on these transfer intentions, and many of them do, we have data that suggests that students who tell you so early that they intend to transfer actually follow through, that in the context of a rating system, these broad access, less selective institutions may be unfairly evaluated. What we don't know, and what the Department of Education has not found a good way to track, is when students transfer from these broad access institutions, many of them may end up go on and be successful elsewhere. Yet, under the current framework put forth in December, it's likely that those broad access institutions may be penalized for not having graduated those students.
Kevin, you know, those students, on the basis of the follow-up work you do, are they transferring because of financial costs? They begin at a less expensive institution and then will, if you will, buy up to potentially a more selective, more prestigious institution in terms of the branding of the degree upon completion? Are they attending a second choice institution, not the one that they most wanted to attend, but another one, and then hope to migrate as well? What's behind some of that? What can you tell us?
So I think that the reasons for intending to transfer and actually following through are quite mixed. I think certainly there are a number of students in the sample who told us on the survey that they were attending their second or third choice institution, and so transfer may be an opportunity to then get into that top choice institution. Others are starting college knowing that they're going to be more mobile, that they're taking a more non-traditional path toward that degree, and particularly in more densely populated areas, there's just greater opportunity to take a couple classes here one term and then go to another institution that maybe has the major that the student's looking for, or as you mentioned, has a better cost or financial aid package for the student.
And Kevin Kruger, across the landscape of NASPA professionals, you know, in one sense they have a responsibility to the students for counseling. If I were to come into your office and say I'm thinking about transfer, you know, at one level it's what are the best interests of the students. On the other hand, what does the institution hope to do in terms of retaining the student, as more and more institutions have focused on retention for all kinds of reasons?
Yeah, obviously the retention is a big issue, but I think Kevin mentioned that, you know, this swirl of enrollment that we're seeing an increase of over the last 5-7 years, a lot of reverse transfers to start at a 4-year institution, go back to a community college, make it to a different institution. The linear path for enrollment seems to be less and less common now, and I think that this data suggests students are prepared for that. I think you also have to factor in the impact of working on campus, working for enrollment, and what that means for students as well. I mean, I think the cost issues really are a factor. The number of students who are working, I think, does sort of affect what they believe they can afford. And so all these things kind of play into a kind of a muddy enrollment pattern for many, many students, particularly, I think, in the low-income sector of higher education.
And Scott Jasek, these data would seem to have consequences in terms of public policy, the proposal from the Obama administration about ratings, retention, degree completion, student success, all seem to be prominent. And yet here we have data from across four-year institutions indicating that whether it's, you know, there's a smaller portion in the most selective institutions, a significant portion in less selective institutions expect to need additional time to complete their degrees, potentially expect to transfer. How will this play out in terms of the ongoing conversation about the ratings and similar initiatives on the part of the states?
Well, I mean, the concern about institutions being punished if their students transfer and they don't get sort of credit for those who are successful is a big issue, particularly with the community college sector, which, as we talked about, isn't reflected in this data. And in fact, I would say if you included community college students, the percentage looking to transfer would be, you know, much, much larger. I actually thought that was an area where what was interesting to me was that students were self-aware, because in fact, students are transferring and they are taking longer to finish their degrees. It was interesting to me to see the comments from our readers on the survey results. People generally thought that the freshmen were self-aware on this. A lot were dubious on whether the freshmen were really honest about how much partying they did as a high school senior, and many thought they were underestimating their social media time. So, you know, there are different issues where students may know more than others.
Before we close, I want to touch on two issues that are closely related. One is degree aspirations, and the other jobs and careers. Kevin Egan, interestingly, in the data, we talked about in the introduction to this segment the fact that women's career aspirations have now surpassed men, but also in the summary materials from your group, the fact that the degree aspirations of first-generation college students now are almost parallel to those of students who are the children of college graduates, striking compared to 40 years ago, almost equal proportions. And clearly, degree aspirations in one part are tied to the job market. The job market has come back. We're through the worst of the Great Recession, if you will. Talk about how these two things seem to interrelate as you look at the data in terms of student career aspirations and job expectations now versus even 3 or 4 years ago.
Sure. So it's clear that students are starting college now in 2014, understanding that a bachelor's degree is not going to be the end point of their educational journey, that in order to advance in their chosen occupation, their chosen career, they may need a master's degree, a doctorate, or a first professional. When we look at some of the changes in careers over time, we see that engineering, computer science, and health professions have grown while in particular, education has suffered, those going into teaching, both at the secondary and elementary level. And so we're seeing that these items on the survey are indeed moving in tandem, that as students are entering careers that may require additional education, they're recognizing that they're going to need additional degrees in order to be successful in those trajectories.
Kevin Egan, let me touch on the education point. There's an article in the New York Times, I believe today, talking about the number of applicants for Teach for America declined significantly this past year. Is that a reflection of the job market? During a down economic cycle, teaching looked okay as a filler if I couldn't go to Wall Street or if I couldn't get other kinds of jobs. As the markets come back, other opportunities emerge, teaching falls off for the most academically able students?
I'm not even sure that teaching was okay as a filler during the recession. We saw that that was remaining fairly constant. And if you look at what happened in the recession, states like California, North Carolina engaged in reduction in force with respect to teachers. And so I think students at the time and who were going through high school at the time were seeing this happen and considering that maybe there's not going to be a job as a teacher. We're just now in California seeing school systems begin to hire back teachers and begin to replace some of those positions that they eliminated several years ago.
And Kevin Kruger, across the landscape of student affairs professionals, those who work with freshmen, those who work with seniors, the job market has changed dramatically in recent years. There's greater pressure, I think, on colleges as well to provide more support and assistance for students in the job process. Talk with us a little bit about that process and how these things have changed in recently.
I think you've hit on something. You have two things happening. A lot of anxiety on the part of, you know, families and the students themselves about getting a job. And so institutions have responded with, I think, a lot more attention trying to get students to think about the career process, not, you know, in the last 6 months of their senior year, but to make that a process that runs as a thread through the entire collegiate experience. I think that's one thing. There's a lot of also anxiety about the fact that, you know, still to this day, you know, there are many students with college, with bachelor degrees that are underemployed. And I think that knowledge, I think, is reflected in the idea of more interest in grad school. I mean, you have to sort of ramp up your own educational credentials to compete in a very in a market where what's required kind of keeps going up and up. And so we have students who are graduating college in jobs that only required that maybe don't even require a college degree. That I think all is putting a lot of pressure and anxiety on the students in this process. I think institutions are responding. It's not just the career service office either. I think not every student takes advantage of the career service office. So we really have to make this more of a integrated approach with advising, orientation, throughout the college experience.
Scott Jasek, let me shift a little bit and ask you for the long view. The Freshman Survey was launched in 1966. It will celebrate its 50th anniversary next year. It is the largest continuing empirical study of American higher education. It's a tremendous source in terms of the annual survey of freshmen, in terms of profiling students. But long before the conversation of outcomes, SERP was doing important work in this area under Alexander Aston, who was the founding director, and many who worked with him. I'm part of that group. Aston was my dissertation advisor, and I worked at Harry for a number of years afterwards. In the context of this project, how important are these data, both in terms of the annual survey of students and the other work that comes out from these data in terms of follow-up studies?
I think they're very important. I mean, one of the pros and cons of this survey is that it covers so many issues. And what I always assume happens on many campuses is that different parts of the campus will focus on different data. I mean, we haven't touched on things like politics and religion and student interests and academic interests. There's all kinds of trends in here that a campus will look to and say, okay, are we ready for the new freshman? Are our services and our assumptions aligned with what they say they want? And that just strikes me as very valuable. Obviously, individual campuses will have their own trends that may or may not match these, but campuses always benefit, I think, from having this sort of data to say, hey, are we providing the right services?
Great. Kevin Egan at UCLA, Kevin Kruger at NASPA, and Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, thank you for the energetic and informative conversation about the 2014 Freshman Survey. In our second segment today, we talk about whether Western colleges should do business in Saudi Arabia. Over the past decade, a number of American and Canadian institutions have developed academic partnerships with governments and ministries in the Middle East. These agreements have often generated significant ethical debates at many institutions about the responsibility of American, Canadian, and European academics to promote Western values given the authoritarian governments, cultural norms, and local laws of Gulf state nations. Many faculty question if these institutional agreements essentially endorse governments and cultures that practice what Westerners view as human rights abuses, that often restrict the advancement of women, that may engage in systematic discrimination against religious minorities and gay people, and that also perform public beheadings and amputations as punishment for criminal offenses. The controversy about the ethics of Western universities in Saudi Arabia escalated in recent weeks with the news that a Saudi blogger was sentenced to 1,000 lashes and 10 years in prison for insulting Islam on his website. The flogging and harsh prison sentence for the Saudi blogger prompted 18 Nobel laureates as well as other academics to petition the president of KAUST, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, to urge academics at KAUST to advocate for freedom of dissent. Launched in 2009 with some $25 million in academic partnerships that involved the University of California at Berkeley, Stanford, and other prominent universities, KAUST was seen by the late Saudi King Abdullah as, quote, a beacon for peace, hope, and reconciliation. Yet some of the prominent American academics who were engaged to help launch these partnerships with KAUST now express concern about an inherent conflict between the Saudi culture and the nation's Islamic traditions, between Western values of free speech and cultural diversity, and KAUST's effort at, again, peace, hope, and reconciliation. Joining us for this conversation are Jack Wilson, a professor of public policy and police safety at Algonquin College in Canada, Liz Riesberg, an international higher education consultant, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Liz, let me begin with you. Why do Western universities seek these partnerships in the Gulf states? Are they only about money, or are there other issues at play and as part of the conversation?
I guess I'm cynical about this, but I think that these partnerships are driven primarily by the potential for revenue.
And Jack, you spoke very prominently about an opposition to an agreement that your college, Algonquin, had in the Gulf States. A concern about revenue and other issues?
It's quite clearly about revenue. In my province, in Ontario, the community colleges are chronically underfunded, and so they are strongly encouraged to look for other revenue sources, and that includes international partnerships. And while I don't think we have a problem with international partnerships per se, we certainly have a problem with countries with dubious human rights records, such as Saudi Arabia.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, you're the journalist with the longer, perhaps a little wider view of some of this. As you've covered this and you watch your colleagues cover this issue, is it money or are there other issues that play in these conversations and these agreements?
Well, I would divide it up a little bit and first talk about, say, scholars. Individual U.S. Western scholars have interests all over the world, and you will find them all over the world, whether it's in the Fulbright program or doing their own research. And they are motivated frequently by whatever is their research area of expertise. And some of those areas of expertise will, in fact, lead them to countries with very dubious human rights records. If you're talking about these big relationships, university to university, setting up a branch campus, helping universities grow, there it would seem much more financially driven. The reality is there are underserved populations in very poor countries, and you don't see a lot of U.S. universities going in and building branch campuses there.
So part of the public statements that we often see in these discussions, aside from the money, which you all seem to agree is a primary motivator, is that the presence of a Western academic partner, not scholars doing research, but an institutional partnership, will be a catalyst for change. Is that a great aspiration? Is it a realistic assessment? Or, Liz, is that a false hope? Liz Riesberg, you've had extensive experience working in some of these institutions and with some of these partnerships.
I'm concerned about the attitude that we hope to bring about change. I see a lot of arrogance in that. The assumption is that we're going to go in and enlighten these cultures and help them achieve social justice and democracy. And I find that a reflection of the lack of preparation and respect with which a lot of institutions enter into partnerships. I don't get a sense that the objectives are as clearly stated to learn about these cultures, to exchange views, to have a deeper understanding of values different than our own. So, you know, I think that there's this kind of rhetoric about making things better abroad by enlightening people, and I'm increasingly concerned about, you know, what's behind that.
And Jack, given the experience of Algonquin and perhaps other Canadian institutions, catalysts for change, false hope, is that a false hope or a realistic expectation?
I don't think it's realistic, and I think it's used as a justification after the fact when they're embarrassed about these partnerships once they become exposed for what they are. In our case, we're providing purely training in business and technical programs. We're not being asked to provide anything in the way of the humanities. We're not being asked to provide any programs related to civic society, to human rights, nothing on what we would consider liberal democratic values. And in fact, we've seen the actual reverse. We have Saudi students who are studying at our campus, and in the Language Institute, we've had to amend our curriculum slightly so as not to offend so-called Saudi sensibilities. And these are classes that are mixed with students from other countries. And the question is, why are we changing our practices to amend Saudi sensibilities? So actually, if anything, the reverse is happening.
Casey, can I jump in?
Please, Liz.
You know, I just wanted to say that, just talk a little bit from my personal experience. I've been working in Saudi Arabia with the government and with several universities over the past 4 years. And I have to say that I went in with all of the prejudice that comes from a media that reports things very selectively. And I think we need to be very careful about generalizing about all of Saudi Arabia based on incidents that we all find reprehensible. I've come to recognize my own prejudices about Saudi Arabia and Saudi culture going in. I've developed a deep respect for many of my colleagues and the work they're doing there, and have begun to understand just the complexity of Saudi society. And I think it's really important that we remember that we don't want universities abroad to judge us by our government at any particular moment in time, and that we need to recognize that societies have a range of points of view and attitudes and values. And I've really come to see Saudi Arabia very differently as a result of my work there.
But Liz, in terms of your work, and let me also bring Scott into this conversation, I'm thinking about the article that appeared in Inside Higher Ed this week, that some of these partnerships, while they often focus on business and technology and engineering, particularly the story about a university for women who are getting trained, and yet there may not be jobs for these women once they complete their degrees through these partnership programs. Liz, and let me then go to Scott.
Well, I was actually stunned by that statement, because if one looks at employment figures in Saudi Arabia, in the past couple of years, the number of women who pursue careers has just grown exponentially. And there are lots of possibilities opening up for women, and for some reason that doesn't seem to be reported. I mean, one of the important parts of the policies of the late king is the fact that if you educate more people, they're going to be pursuing more opportunities in the job market, and the job market may well open opportunities for them, and that is exactly what's happening. Perhaps not at the pace we'd like to see, but it is definitely happening, and there are data to back that up.
Scott, on the other hand, the article that appeared in Inside Higher Ed this week suggested that, yes, there, as Liz states, that there are opportunities opening up, but there's still more supply than demand in terms of women coming out of some of these programs.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the education of women transforms societies. It was interesting, President Obama, in his trip to India, specifically gave a talk about how important it is to educate women, and how countries that have gotten more successful are generally the countries that have educated women. Saudi Arabia is educating a lot more women. The ethical issues that come into play, I think, have to do with the rest of society. So you have institutions in Saudi Arabia that are right now doing a lot more for women than they have in the past. You have places like KAUST that within their walls have much more freedom than exists elsewhere in the country. But the critics are saying, you know what, there are norms that are not reached. We shouldn't be helping these countries build up their societies. And if you look at the great universities of the West and of other countries, I think there's an argument to be made that you need a civil society, you need free speech to truly take full advantage of the greatness of a university.
Let's go back to the issue of cultural change, if I may. Institute for International Education's Open Doors report reveals that Saudi Arabia is the fourth largest source of foreign students in the United States, some 53,000 students that represent about 6% of the foreign students. The numbers from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are increasing. If, in fact, part of the goal, or at least the publicly stated goal, is cultural change, is it not better to have these students come to the United States or Canada or Europe, where they get the full Western academic experience, as opposed to a limited one at an institution that's co-sponsored or involved with partnerships? Jack, let me begin that. Take that one first to you.
I would agree completely, and I've had firsthand experience with a student in my class who we were talking about human rights and got onto the issue of sexual orientation, and this one student was shocked to think that people who were gay had rights in Canada. And in fact, he said, in my country, we would have that person executed. And the rest of the students were stunned by that comment, and we then engaged in a respectful discussion. And I think that discussion certainly helped our students, our Canadian students, realize that people have quite strong views on issues that we might think are already settled. And for the student, it opened his eyes to the fact that what he believes is a cultural norm in his country is not necessarily accepted in the rest of the world. So I think that very singular incident for me really pointed out to me the value of having people come to our country to study.
Liz, I'm guessing that you probably have conversations with your Saudi colleagues and clients about higher education in the United States. I'm thinking about my own experience in Bahrain some years ago, where I was with a number of academics from a number of Gulf state nations who had an experience at American universities and were adamant that certainly clear that they wanted their children to have that same experience, even as they were grounded in their own countries, grounded in their own cultures, and they were able to very much differentiate, for example, this is during the middle of the early years of the Iraq War, their anger at the American government as opposed to their warm feelings for the American people and their own experiences, what they want their children to experience. Again, if part of the goal is cultural transmission and Western values, better to have those students join us here as opposed to do these institutional partnerships there.
There's several issues. You know, this is not just a simple yes. I'd like to just quickly go back to a comment that was made earlier about the fact that in Saudi Arabia, the supply of women graduates into the market exceeds demand for, so that they're not all being employed. Can I just point out that we need to keep perspective on this and the fact that you could easily say that in the United States, the current supply of university graduates exceeds the demand for them in the labor market. So, you know, one of the things I worry about is that we tend to, Saudi Arabia is an easy target because of some of their government policies, which, by the way, I do not support at all. But they're an easy target, and I think we need to keep some perspective about the behavior of other countries and other governments around the world that may not always be all that different. If I can come back to the experience of Saudi students on U.S. campuses, I think that's an important piece of this internationalization of higher education, but I don't think that's sufficient. I think we need to engage in different levels, in different ways. And again, the learning has to go in two directions. There's been some interesting coverage in the press lately about the lack of support, respect, and integration of international students on our campuses. I think that we're not doing near enough to help American students understand the cultural differences of the students who come to the U.S., and as a result, we've seen examples of prejudice and bigotry directed at these international students, and I don't think that that will do a whole lot to improve this mutual understanding unless U.S. campuses start doing a little bit more work at home to make sure those environments are respectful and welcoming.
Scott Jasek, what are the risks in these relationships, both the efforts of institutions in the United States, Canada, and Europe to recruit students from the Gulf states? Clearly, revenue drives a lot of that, and also the risk of the institutional relationships.
Well, there are a lot of risks. As relates to the financing, many of the relationships in other countries are backed by particular government or leader. And as those leaders change, there may not be similar interest in backing those relationships in the same way. Politics can change. You know, countries that were once open to these sorts of relationships may or may not be in the future. Technology changes it. All kinds of things beyond our control can change the nature of these relationships. It's also important to remember, though, that coming to the United States isn't an option for everyone, and including for the issue of women, Western-style institutions in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere report enrolling many women whose families would never permit them to come to the United States. So, and our own policies sometimes are more friendly than not at letting students in. So there's so many interrelated parts of this issue that need consideration.
Great. Jack Wilson and Liz Riesberg and also Scott Jasek, thank you for your perspectives on a complex and important issue for many institutions. Our thanks as well to Kevin Egan from UCLA and Kevin Kruger from NASPA for the conversation about the UCLA Freshman Survey. This Week in Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.